except for an old chest freezer, boxes of junk stacked on shelves, and a workbench with scattered tools on it. He went straight for the tool bench. It didn't take more than a few minutes to find what he needed to break open the garage door and get inside the house. A club hammer and a chisel, perfect tools to destroy any wooden door frame. Once inside, he was more careful not to make any noise, but all of the lights were off and there was no sign that anyone was home. He wasn't really expecting otherwise. The Tesla was missing and there weren't any other cars around. Andrew's own truck was probably the only vehicle parked in the entire neighborhood. A quick survey of the house didn't reveal much. No laptop, no phone, no hints or clues anywhere that might indicate where David had come to. There was no basement, and the giant firearm safe in the main bedroom was locked. Even if there was something in there besides guns, it would be impossible to access it.
"Damn it!"
Andrew screamed. He made a fist and lashed out at the wall of the upstairs hallway, hard enough to put a dent in it. He could go up to San Francisco and check the other address, but chances were it would be abandoned, too. San Diego seemed to be a more likely location anyway, especially with Professor Hughes and Adriana Claremont's brother both missing from the area. So what now? Maybe David didn't leave, he thought. Maybe he's just out stalking his next victim. That thought, and all of its sinister implications, sent a chill down his spine. That was definitely possible. After all, it was the middle of the night. He needed to wait around and see if time bore out his theory. If David wasn't gone yet, then he'd be home soon. And if not, then Andrew would head up to San Francisco and check out the next dead-end lead. He absently checked his phone. He'd been half-hoping to receive a call from that FBI agent. Nothing, but there was another missed call from Selena. Maybe now was a good time to call her and get her up to speed. And to find the charger in his car. His phone's battery was down to 7%. Andrew had a few other preparations to make, too, just in case David Wilkes did return. Couldn't have him tipped off by the busted side door leading to the garage. He'd jam the garage door shut and make sure that Wilkes had to park in the driveway. That would force him to come through the front door instead. "And I'll be right here waiting for him when he does," Andrew thought. 12. Roland. 5 days left. The motel was so stuffy, Roland thought he was going to suffocate. He ran to the windows, sliding them open with a thrust. The frames were dirty, rusted from misuse, but they finally sprang wide, letting in fresh air. He'd arrived at the vacant property and had let himself in, taking the first unit he found a key for. The closed sign had been on the door, but that was nothing a rock and perseverance hadn't been able to fix. For 2 days he'd hidden in the room, somehow expecting the man and woman in the van to track him down and shoot him in his sleep. The room wasn't air-conditioned, and it was sweltering inside. Even the breeze finding the inside of his suite now brought a humid, wet feel with it. 2 days of hiding. It was enough. He couldn't find the warehouse and learn what Lewis Hound was doing if he was too scared to leave this pit behind. Roland grabbed his laptop and anything resembling his property and lifted the mattress off the wooden frame. He shoved his gear under it, letting the stained mattress fall with a thud. His pack had 3 water bottles and some nuts, along with binoculars and his cell phone. He exited the room, pocketing the key and moving to his truck. He'd traded his car for it with an old man who was heading inland. The truck was worthless, and the old guy had been tickled pink at the bargain he was getting. Roland hoped the gun-wielding duo had chosen to follow his car inland instead of following him to Cape Town. It was a do-or-die world, and he wasn't going to feel guilty if the new owner of the car was a casualty of war. The truck's engine roared to life, sputtering a bit, but it kept running. Roland leaned forward, trying to see the tops of the immense redwoods all around him. They were at least 1,000 years old. Would the trees survive the coming apocalypse? Would nature thrive once again? "Worry about yourself, not the damned trees," Roland told himself, and pulled the lever beside the steering wheel, thrusting the beat-up truck forward. The roads were empty here, no one for miles, it seemed. Roland had watched enough zombie movies and read enough post-apocalyptic books to feel uneasy at the solitude. He kept nervously scanning the sides of the roads, half expecting a horde of the undead to emerge and rip him limb from limb. The fuel gauge was low on the truck, and he cursed himself for not being more prepared. He needed gas and a jerry can for backup. Old wooden signs stuck out of the ditches claiming food and lodging ahead. That would mean a gas station. The truck began lurching, and Roland tapped the dial, hoping the fuel gauge would hop up a tenth of an inch. It did quite the opposite. The truck stalled out in the middle of the road, and Roland cursed his luck. Rain began falling, a kick you when you're down from the universe.
Raleigh, you think you're so smart, but step out into the real world and you're just another dummy trying to survive.
It wasn't quite the pep talk he needed. He pulled up the map on his phone and saw he was 2 miles from the nearest gas station. 2 miles. He could do that. He hopped out, wishing he had a raincoat, and slung his pack over his shoulder, walking towards the right side of the road. His mood was sour already, and he glanced at his shoes, which were soaked in mere minutes. His long brown hair clung to his face, and he wiped it away. It felt like an hour later when he grabbed his phone, ducking over to keep it from getting wet, and saw that he was only halfway. It had also only been 14 minutes. The rest of the trip was a mixture of panic and frustration. His gaze darted to both sides of the redwood-lined road, and he peered behind him every few seconds, fearing the arrival of a white, unmarked van. By the time he saw the unlit gas station sign, he was miserable, wishing he'd stayed home.
"Please be functioning," he told the gas pumps, and saw they were still powered up.
There was a shabby house behind the station, telling him the owners lived there. Roland noticed that there were no cars parked near it, and the only truck in the lot was rusted and missing 2 of its 4 wheels. The convenience store attached to the gas station was closed, chains wrapped around the door handles. Roland ducked around the other side, searching for another entrance, and found the back door locked, but not chained. He pulled a loose chunk of concrete from the pad and hefted it at the wooden door, breaking the handle clean off. From there, he was able to use his fingers to turn the latch, and the rear door swung wide. Maybe he was getting the hang of this after all. Hacker turned gas station thief. Wouldn't his grandmother be so proud? He shook his head, sending water spraying all around the cluttered office, and emerged into the dark store. No one had pillaged it yet, which was a good sign. Roland set his pack on the counter and began his search for supplies. He found 2 bright red gas cans and stacked them near the back door, going in for more. He filled a canvas bag with water, some energy drinks, and chocolate bars, before realizing there might be more useful things like a flashlight and batteries, which he took as well. His clothes were soaked through, and Roland slung them off, tossing the shirt and sweater in a damp heap near the front doors, choosing cheesy replacements from a clothing rack. His t-shirt was plain, but the black sweater had a picture of a redwood on it and said, "I've been to the redwoods and all I got was this lousy splinter." It was terrible, but he adorned it with a smile. He was almost dry. A hat was next, and he slipped the green cap over his head. Behind the counter was a coat hook, and Roland found a yellow slicker that was at least 3 sizes too big for his small frame. He put it on anyway.
"Time to skedaddle," he told himself, and moved for the rear exit when the sound of an engine carried to his ears.
Roland's stomach rose into his throat when he saw the doors of the big truck swing open to reveal 2 armed men. They weren't the same ones from his house, but they seemed a lot more nefarious. He pressed his body against the near wall and watched as one of them stuck his face to the front door, scanning inside. Roland ducked low, seeing a rifle in the man's grip. Were they looking for him? He was a dead man, so close but so far away. Perhaps they'd spotted his truck down the road and knew he'd come here. What was he going to do? The rifle rang out, striking the glass doors and shattering one of them. He could hear the man laughing, and he peered around a shelf full of jerky to see the second man, this one as wide as a semi-truck, using his leather sleeve to clear shards of glass from the metal frame.
"You done good, brother. Let's take this shit and keep moving. I always hated the McKenzies. Kind of wish they were still here, though. That daughter of theirs is a real piece of work."
The man's voice was high-pitched, a contradiction to his immense girth. Roland had his pack in his hand and reached inside, feeling the metal grip of his pistol. It didn't seem like these guys were here for him, but he knew their type. He could only guess what they'd do to a witness out here, and it wasn't going to be good.
"Remember that time old man McKenzie waved that gun in my face?" the man with the rifle asked. "What a tool. Let's clear this out and check the house. Maybe he's in there waiting for the end of the world,"
the fat guy said. Roland wondered what his chances were of escaping with his life. He glanced at the empty gas cans, aware he couldn't leave without filling them. He couldn't go wandering around searching for the next station. Out here in the middle of nowhere, it could be hours before he found one. The big truck sat outside idling, and Roland had an idea. He waited until the two men were behind the counter tearing open the register, and he made for the rear door. He decided to leave the gas cans, taking his backpack as well as the canvas full of supplies, and made his way in the rain around the building. He stopped, heart pounding in his chest. The pistol was firm in his grip, and he dropped the gun as he adjusted the bags in his hands. It fell into a puddle, and he crouched behind a barrel, hoping the big brothers hadn't heard anything. When neither of them emerged through the front of the building, he grabbed the pistol, shoved it into his new rain jacket's pocket, and made for the truck. He was a big yellow target, and he tried not to think about this as he crossed the gravel parking lot. The shot rang out, kicking up dirt a yard from his feet, and he skidded to a halt.
"What do we have here, Danny?"
The man with the rifle was younger than Roland had thought, maybe only 20. His big brother sauntered out, a bag of jerky in his meaty grip.
"If it ain't a yellow bird, what do we do with yellow birds?"
Danny asked.
"We hunt them, ain't that right, Danny?"
The rifle aimed toward him, and Roland tried to think of a solution. He dropped the canvas bag to the ground and set his pack gently on the cement, raising his arms in the air.
"I just need gas. I'm not here for trouble,"
he said as confidently as he could. It still came out with a waver in pitch.
"Seems to me you was going to steal our truck, don't it, Colin?"
Danny asked his brother. The rifle rang out, this time coming closer to Roland's feet. This was it. He was never going to find out what was going on at Cape Town. He'd never see the warehouse with his own two eyes. He'd never even live to see the earth die. The big one stepped forward, eyeing the bag of supplies, then Roland.
"What you got on you, son?"
he asked, even though Roland was sure he was older than the guy.
"Nothing,"
he told them blankly. The man's weight crunched the gravel as he approached. Roland's hand twitched. A gun appeared in Danny's fat palm, and he began to lift it up. His eyes were a killer's, close set and black. Roland was sure these two had killed already, maybe done worse than kill. He needed to get out of here. He needed to find Cape Town. Roland's hand jammed into his jacket pocket, pulling the pistol out. He fired two quick shots, both missing the wide target. He ran behind the truck and ducked so he could crawl underneath. He aimed at the big man's legs and found a thigh with a bullet. Colin was firing the rifle now, and gravel shot out, hitting Roland in the eyes. He blinked the dust away and rolled out from under the truck. Danny was cursing on the ground, and the rifle-wielding brother was running toward Roland. Roland ran in zigzags, trying to make himself a hard target. He heard another shot, and Colin stomped, attempting to reload. Thunder boomed around them, lightning striking an immense redwood, sending an earth-shattering crash throughout the entire area. Colin stared in the direction of the sound, and Roland took his chance. He ran at the man and fired three quick shots. He stumbled, falling to the ground, and watched as Colin fell to his knees. Blood pooled from his chest, staining his white t-shirt. Danny was yelling, shooting his own handgun toward Roland from his seated position. Roland grabbed his supplies as he ran by, hopping into the truck's driver's side. The side mirror exploded as Danny shot it, and Roland raced off, leaving the brothers in the parking lot both bleeding in the rain. In the rearview mirror, he saw Colin fall face first into a pool of water, his brother struggling to crawl over to him. It was an hour later that Roland finally slowed the vehicle. He'd raced down the empty streets at 70 miles an hour, skidding through sharp corners, expecting them to give chase. They didn't. And finally, the rational part of his mind told him they were dead. At least one of them was, the other injured from his gunshot wound to the thigh. He wouldn't be driving anytime soon. Roland's nerves were fried.
and he pulled onto the side of the road, finally letting himself check the map. He'd missed his turnoff, not seeing any signs for Cape Town. He had to double back. Every instinct was telling him to keep driving, farther away from the body he'd left behind, but he fought it. With a grunt, he turned the truck around and finally found the turnoff to Cape Town. The entire place was deserted. He passed a single house with a porch light on, shining like a beacon on the dark, stormy day. He kept moving, dead set on the coast. Finally, he could see the water once again. There were a couple houses with for sale signs on them, but sadly, they would never sell. There was no one left in this part of the world, or at least it felt that way. Once on the coastal road, he flicked the lights off, but the daylights stayed on. Roland thought about busting the headlights, but continued searching for the warehouse. Rain was pouring rapidly, the wipers moving so fast it was hard to see anything beyond the windshield. Then he spotted the building a mile or so down the coast. This had to be it. He parked, grabbing his binoculars. The warehouse had a fence all the way around it, a tall one with barbed wire at the top. He scanned the horizon, making out an industrial dock, even in the deluge. From here he couldn't see any cars or boats, but this had to be the place. Roland was beat, emotionally and physically drained after the crazy day, and he decided to find a hiding spot for his truck. The rain began to let up, and he found a side road leading to the beach. The truck drove over the rocky pathway with ease, and Roland tucked it between a copse of trees, finding minor shelter from the weather and from prying eyes. With shaking hands, he popped a pill bottle open, took two, then added a third and popped them into his mouth, wishing they made him feel better instantly. He sat in silence, searching for signs of humanity, but not seeing any for the next hour. By the time the rain stopped, he knew it was time to scout closer. Roland chugged an energy drink, then grabbed two water bottles and his gun, pills, and food, filling his backpack. He shoved the bright yellow jacket into the bag, just in case. If he wore it, he'd be the world's worst spy, but it would keep him dry if the sky wanted to unleash hell upon him again. The ground was wet, and his pants were soaked to the knees within minutes, but he moved quickly and quietly, with a grace he hadn't realized he was capable of. When he was about half a mile from the fence, he nestled into the forest bed, lying down facing the warehouse. He pulled the binoculars out and watched. And waited. 13. Kendra. 5 days left.
"I don't give a rat's ass who you are. There's no time for idiocy," the captain said. He was new, brought in from a different precinct after this station's captain had up and fled for the hills. Kendra suspected they were going to see a lot of that.
"I want any information you have on this Mr. Tesla," she said, dropping the paper with the plate numbers on it.
He glanced at it and shook his head. "I've been told to keep the peace around here, not waste my resources to help a lone wolf FBI agent going rogue."
He crumpled the paper up and tossed it toward his garbage can, hitting the edge and missing.
"Now, if you'll excuse me, I have pressing matters."
Before she let him push her out of the office, she flashed a picture.
"This is Officer Lisa Tremble. She's one of the missing people. For God's sake, do you care about anyone but yourself?"
Kendra shouted. She was growing weary of everyone around her constantly butting heads. Weren't they supposed to be on the same side? He glanced at it and shrugged.
"I'm new. I haven't met her.
She's been gone for a week. Her husband's been here 3 times, and no one will talk to him. Is that how you treat your own?"
Kendra lowered her voice, realizing she'd drawn attention to herself. The officers outside the captain's temporary workstation were watching them. A uniformed woman stuck her head in the office.
"Captain, the 5 is clogged to the gills. We have no idea what can be done. Someone ran into an electrical box on the north end, killing 2 sets of lights, making it worse. What can we do?"
she asked.
"Jesus. I should have retired when I had the chance. Take someone with you and do some old-school traffic directing, would you?" he asked.
"Excuse me, did you know Lisa Tremble?"
Kendra asked the officer, and the captain dropped his pen to his desktop.
"Fine, tell this special agent what you can, and maybe she'll stop sniffing around here like a hungry cat."
He ran his hands through his thinning gray hair.
"She's a good cop. We came up in the academy together. Then last week she just disappeared," the woman told her. Why haven't you helped her husband?
Kendra asked.
Because we don't have the resources. The world is going to hell, don't you see that?
I don't even know why I'm here, she said quietly, leading Kendra from the captain's office.
There's a Walmart on fire in La Mesa, someone shouted from behind them. Send the fire department, another voice returned.
It was madness out there. The phones were ringing off the hook. The cacophony of noise was sending Kendra into a near panic attack. She had to leave as quickly as possible.
Do you have any paperwork on?
Kendra started, but she stopped when she saw the president's face appear on a big screen hung on the far wall. Everyone moved for it, leaving the phones to ring.
Everyone shut up! The captain was there, front and center, turning up the volume. It brings me tremendous sadness to relay this message to the great people of the United States of America. With the coming catastrophes being predicted, FEMA has declared that the entire West Coast must be evacuated within 72 hours, the president said, his face older and more weathered than ever.
Everyone inside the police station spoke at once, and the captain silenced them with a firm glare. He turned the volume up a couple more notches.
We're setting up temporary shelters in Texas and Louisiana. Visit the website below for each site's location. The following states must be cleared out in the next 3 days: California, Arizona, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. This includes everybody, with the exception of government-mandated personnel.
What are we supposed to do?
A man asked, his voice panicked.
We help, then we leave, the captain said.
Kendra was surprised he was even going that far. At least they'd be able to assist the evacuation. Seeing the president speak on this made it all far more real. It was truly happening.
I'm sorry it's come to this. We're working on solutions, so stay tuned for further instructions. We hope to understand more about the activity surrounding Yellowstone's supervolcano, and we'll advise on our action plan in the hours and days to come. Godspeed.
The image flashed away to a desk with two newscasters who looked utterly deflated.
You heard the man. We need everyone on this. Don't even think about leaving until we have every damn San Diego citizen two states over. Got it?
The captain's voice cut over the chatter. Kendra grabbed her things and headed for a computer, hoping to access the DMV database.
Can I help you with that?
A man asked. He wasn't in uniform, but he had the glint of a cop in his eye.
I need to trace this plate. I need the address, Kendra told him.
No problem. It'll only be a minute, he said,
his fingers flying across the keyboard. It took all of 10 seconds, and he printed the address off, passing it to her.
Thanks for the help,
she told him, snatching Mr. Tesla's residence.
Did you work with Lisa Tremble?
Sure did. Is she okay? Did you find her?
He asked, his face hopeful. Kendra shook her head.
Not yet, but...
She held the paper up with the address.
I intend to.
It was raining again outside, and she tucked the paperwork under her jacket, running for her car. A gunshot rang out in the distance, and the now constant sound of emergency vehicles sang across the air in every direction. With the president's recent statement, the ever-growing pandemonium was only going to get worse. Kendra mapped out the address, but it told her to drive directly through town, which she found to be endlessly gridlocked. She tried every which way on the nav, but each of them showed the lines to be dark red, telling her none of the roadways were moving. She had to make it across town, and most of the people were attempting to merge onto the 8 so they could cut inland, away from the city and the coast. Others were hoping for quieter pathways and were moving toward the smaller highways on the north and south edges of town. It left Kendra sitting there in the parking lot of the station, wondering where the hell she should go. At the current pace, it told her the normally 20-minute drive was going to take 5 hours. All the work, all the years of effort, studying harder than anyone at university to earn that damned finance degree from Berkeley just to make her father proud. What a joke. The same father who couldn't bear the weight of losing a daughter and became distant with the one who remained. Kendra had pushed that aside, her heart growing number by the year, and she became an agent, hell-bent on finding Carrie. But she never had. 10 years with the FBI, no husband, no real friends, and all she had to show for it was a tiny condo devoid of anything remotely personal on the walls. She took a deep breath, staring out across the street, hearing the car horns, the sirens, and the thunder rolling in. What was it all for? She leaned over, tossing the tablet and notebooks onto the passenger seat. It was time to give up the charade. It was time to move away from the coast like everyone else. 3 days. This entire city was going to go up in flames before the next 72 hours ticked by on the clock, and Kendra didn't want to be here to see it. She had a bag of clothes and supplies packed in her trunk. She could just leave. Yes, it was time. She had a new resolve. No one else might care about what happened to Special Agent Kendra Baker, but she did. She hadn't worked her ass off all these years so she could sit here and cry about it when times were tough. Kendra threw the car in drive, checked the passenger side mirror, and saw a picture that had slid out of the file folder. It was a young woman, a shot from her social media page. Kendra pressed the brake and pulled it out for a closer look. The hope in her eyes matched Kendra's own at that tender age of 24. That was around the same time things had started going to crap in her own life. The woman was a veterinarian, recently graduated. She'd gone missing along with the pile of others. She read the name, Alicia Chang. Alicia smiled in the photo, holding a diploma in veterinary science.
You can't let them go.
Kendra rubbed her temples. Her sister would want her to keep searching, to find them before they were killed, either by a maniacal kidnapper or by the harsh elements sure to destroy the West Coast. She chose the path that gave her the fastest route to Mr. Tesla's home, anticipating it would lead her there sooner rather than later. 10 minutes passed, and she was hating her decision. All lanes were filled with cars. No one was obeying the rules of the lights any longer. Cars were randomly running reds, crashing into each other, creating even more chaos. She turned onto a side street, finding a little reprieve, and made another left, hoping to eventually turn onto the freeway. For now, she was moving, albeit slowly, but it was progress. It was a strange part of town, one she hadn't spent much time in, and the buildings were a little more dilapidated. She passed a few money-lending businesses, a pawn shop, 2 liquor stores, then conveniently a church, before she spotted the trouble. The man was clearly high. His movements were too fast, too choppy to be natural. And even from down the block, she could see the entire whites of his wide-open eyes. The gun in his hand flashed around him erratically as he approached a rusty minivan. Kendra saw the woman behind the wheel try to roll the window up, but he didn't care. He smashed it with the butt of the gun and yelled at her to step out. Kendra had to act. She pulled over, jumping out, staying low, and moved around the rear of her own car, crouching as she ran toward the minivan. The man's yelling was offensive, hard to listen to.
Get out of the van! I will shoot your children! I will take their bodies with me and I will eat their hearts.
I'm going to let you live, though, so you can remember their faces watching you from the windows as I drive off with them.
He started off screaming his comments, but by the end of his speech he was casually speaking.
What do you want? Take the van and leave us alone!
The woman screeched. Kendra was on the far side of the van now, her heart fluttering in her chest. This was what she was trained for. This was why she spent 10 hours a month at the shooting range.
It's too late for that. Don't you see? They're coming. We're all dead. They're coming.
The man's words were clearly those of a drug-fueled mind, but they still sent goosebumps over Kendra's arms. They're coming.
Who's coming?
The woman cried. Kendra stood up, peering through the rear window to see the man's gaze inch up to the sky. His hand rose to point at the clouds, and she knew it was her moment. She quickly moved around the van, aiming her Glock at the man's head.
Drop the gun, get on the ground.
The man's eyes opened even wider, if that was possible, and a sick smile spread across his face. His gun rose in the air, aiming directly at the woman in the van, and Kendra didn't hesitate. She fired. It only took one shot. He crumpled to the cement, his gun clattering beside him. The woman was screaming, the kids crying from within the minivan. Kendra walked over to the madman and kicked his gun away, peering into the van. The middle-aged woman's cheeks were wet, and 3 kids howled from their seats.
Be careful.
You have somewhere to go? Kendra asked her.
Thank you,
the woman stuttered.
You're welcome. Do you have somewhere to go?
She repeated.
Texas. We're on the list for one of the shelters near Fort Worth, she told Kendra.
Good. Kendra crouched low, picking up the man's gun. It was scraped on the side, and she released the magazine, checking if there were any bullets. There were 5 rounds left. She passed the gun to the woman inside the van.
Protect your family.
Kendra wasn't sure if this was a good move, but she didn't have time to worry about the moral implications. The kids stopped crying. One of them choked back a sob. He stared at Kendra, clutching a toy truck in his hands.
Thank you,
the woman said again, and tore down the road. Kendra glanced at the body in the street, but left him there to rot. All she felt was a cold detachment as she slid into her car and kept driving toward the address where the man in the Tesla lived. She needed to get to this home, to find him, and find out where he'd taken those people. She gritted her teeth as she turned at a 4-way stop and saw the long line of red taillights and heard the symphony of honking horns.
It was going to be a long day. 14. Andrew, 5 days left. Andrew had spent an entire day waiting around in David's house, eating his food, and then cleaning up the subsequent mess to avoid tipping the guy off if he came home. He even returned to his truck in the middle of the day to catch a few hours of sleep. He slept in 1-hour increments, setting alarms on his phone to wake him and then leaving it in his pocket on vibrate. He'd only allowed himself to do that because he'd set noise traps in the street to alert him if a quiet-running Tesla cruised past. Beer cans and garbage mostly, but he'd scattered some broken glass too, hoping it would puncture the guy's tires. But all of those preparations had been pointless. Here Andrew was, almost 24 hours later, sitting in the dark at the breakfast table in David's house. He didn't want to admit it, but it was time to go. David wasn't coming back here, and waiting any longer would only ensure that the trail leading to Val grew even colder than it already was. He checked his phone, an obsessive habit now. No calls from unknown numbers. A bitter rebuke flashed through his thoughts. Why the hell didn't I ask for that FBI agent's number? If he had, at least he'd be able to recognize her call when it came in, or call her to see if she'd turned up any new leads. Andrew's heart began to pound with anxiety and frustration. He set his gun down for a second to rub his tired, scratchy eyes. It was 2 a.m. on Thursday. That meant Val had been missing for 3.5 days. It was too long. He shuddered to think about where she was, who she was with, what her abductors were doing to her and the others they'd taken. But one thing reassured him. Too many people were missing for this to be the work of an everyday vanilla psycho. He ticked off points on one hand. Victims were both male and female, of wildly varying ages, and from all across the state. No, all across the country. Wasn't that what Selena had said? He struggled to remember and mentally kicked himself for never watching the news. He thought about turning on David's TV to get an earful of whatever was playing on cable, assuming the guy even had cable. But no, there was still a remote chance that David could come home. And getting shot in the back of the head while he gawked at the news would be a really stupid way to die. Val was counting on him. He couldn't afford to be stupid right now. Andrew grabbed his gun and phone charger from the table and stood up. It was time to head for the second address. Maybe both black Teslas were a part of the same operation? Maybe he wasn't dealing with one car and one abductor, but 2. The guy he was looking for was either David Wilkes, or... He pulled the crumpled receipt from his pocket and smoothed it on his thigh to remind himself of the second address. He had to tuck his gun into his waistband and use his phone's flashlight to illuminate the piece of paper. Harry Dorsett, 2563 47th Avenue, San Francisco. That was his next stop. Please be there, he whispered to himself, but he knew how slim his chances were at this point. A familiar ache spread inside of him, and suddenly his mouth was bone dry. Andrew spun around, aiming his flashlight app at David's refrigerator. The guy had left 6-pack of beer in there. Salivating at the thought, he warred with himself over reverting to old habits. He drew on his usual source of willpower and summoned Val's face to mind. It worked, but it also left him feeling more desperate than ever. What if he never saw her again? What if she wasn't even alive anymore? He gritted his teeth and shook his head to clear away those thoughts. He couldn't give up yet. He couldn't... Andrew realized he was still staring at the refrigerator, but he was frozen in place, unable to turn away. He could have one beer. Or even all three. That wouldn't make him drunk. But he knew he wouldn't stop with half a six-pack. He'd dig through the cupboards and find something else, and then he'd wake up blacked out on David's couch, and if his luck was really shitty, he wouldn't wake up at all because David would have come home and put a bullet in his head while he slept off the binge. All of that flashed through Andrew's mind in an instant, and he tore his eyes away from the kitchen and the lure of the beer in the refrigerator. He strode back through David's combined living and dining room, heading for the hallway to the front door. The beam of his phone's flashlight app flickered through the dining room. The furniture was ornate and mostly wooden. Maybe this was David's grandparents' place? Something caught his eye and he slowed to a stop, staring blankly at a dining room hutch that sat awkwardly in the hall. It was partially blocking the way to the front door. Odd to put a big piece of furniture like that in a hallway. There was an old tea set inside with floral patterns on it. The hutch sat kitty-corner to a couch, instead of in the dining room where it would have made more sense. Andrew frowned, the placement of the furniture niggling in the back of his mind. He scanned the dining room with his flashlight. There was an empty corner that would have been perfect for the hutch, and a rectangular patch of floorboards stood out in a darker, richer color than the surrounding floor. The hutch used to be there, he realized. Someone had dragged it over here to the middle of the hall. That was when Andrew noticed the scuff marks in front of the hutch. It looked like it had been repeatedly dragged back and forth. His eyes widened as he realized what that meant. The hutch was blocking something. Andrew slid his phone into his pocket and dragged the hutch away from the wall. His nerves were tingling with anticipation and dread. The hutch came away to reveal a door behind it with the knob removed. A deadbolt had been installed instead, and there was a thin metal handle beneath it, both of which had been perfectly concealed by the bulky furniture. Andrew ran for the side door leading to the garage, burst through it, and grabbed the club hammer and chisel he'd used to break in. It only took him a minute to open the hidden door. As soon as he did, he set the tools aside and pulled out his gun and phone. He used the flashlight to light the way as he cracked the door open and peered around the ruined door jamb. An unfinished wooden staircase led into a basement, and an awful smell wafted up to greet him. His sinking feeling turned to gut-clenching horror. Andrew resisted the urge to bury his nose in his sleeve. He could see the faint glow of a light coming from downstairs. Someone was there. Was David with them? Andrew flicked off his flashlight and began creeping down the stairs. A row of wooden beams came up on his left and he peered through them. Now he could see the source of the smell. His heart leapt into his throat and rage made his whole body shake. His gaze darted, gun and flashlight tracking, his thumb poised to flick off the safety. The basement was unfinished, the walls roughed in with 2x4s, so Andrew could see everything in one glance. David wasn't here, but one of his victims was. Val. She was lying in her underwear on a bare mattress in the far corner of the basement. There were bruises on her arms, and she was chained to a 2x4 that was part of an unfinished room's walls. Dark, sweat-matted hair cascaded over the side of the mattress and splayed on the concrete floor beside her. Terror and fear uncoiled inside of Andrew, and a ragged scream burst from his lips.
Val!
He ran to her side, but as he drew near, he could see that it wasn't her. Too old, too mature, too much body fat. And she hadn't reacted when he'd called out. Andrew feared the worst as he rounded the mattress to examine her face. Her eyes were shut, one of them purpled and swollen. A standing lamp was the sole illumination in the windowless basement. Andrew dropped to his haunches beside the woman and checked her pulse. A vein jumped weakly under his fingertips.
He shook her gently by the shoulder.
Hey,
he whispered. No response. He tried again, shaking her harder this time. Still nothing. She was unconscious, probably drugged, but at least she was alive. Andrew stood up, surveying the scene. A metal bucket sat to one side of the woman, evidently the source of the smell. On the other side, he spotted a half-empty case of bottled water, a bar of soap, dirty towels, clothes, and sheets, along with some scattered boxes of cookies and crackers. This woman had been chained up and left here, like an animal. And based on the bruises all over her, that wasn't the extent of the horror she'd endured. Andrew's lip curled. David Wilkes was his guy, all right, but if he'd done this to one of his victims, what had he done to the others? Andrew's mind raced, dark thoughts swirled. And he vowed that if he and David ever crossed paths, he'd make the man suffer. He shook himself out of a brutal daydream. He had to free this woman and take her to a hospital. He went to examine the 2x4 she was chained to. It was padlocked, but maybe he could cut it with some of the tools from the garage. Just then, the plywood ceiling thundered with hurried footsteps. An electric jolt of adrenaline flooded Andrew's veins. He flew across the basement and hid under the unfinished stairs.
"Melanie?"
a gruff voice called. Footsteps pounded down the stairs. Andrew's entire body tensed, ready for action. He judged his moment and then sprang out of cover and grabbed the man's ankle through the wall of 2x4s beside the stairs.
"Melanie, what the hell?"
Andrew yanked his legs through the wall, jamming David's crotch into one of the 2x4s. He grunted, and a handgun went skipping down the stairs. Andrew aimed his own gun at the man's chest and thumbed off the safety.
"David?" he asked, still gripping the man's ankle and squeezing it as hard as he could.
"Who the hell are you?"
the man asked, blinking rapidly.
"I'm the last person you're ever going to meet if you don't tell me what I want to know."
Andrew tied David Wilkes up with zip ties from the garage and then chained him to one of the 2x4 posts in the basement, just like his victim. That woman remained unconscious. That was for the best. She didn't need to see this.
"You don't know who you're messing with,"
David spat.
"If you let me go, I'll do you a favor and forget this ever happened."
Andrew ignored him.
"Hey, are you listening to me?"
He didn't even spare the man a glance. When he was satisfied that David couldn't go anywhere, he went upstairs to gather a few things. He returned with a jerry can from the garage that he'd filled with water, a rag, and a high-backed dining room chair that he could tie David to in order to get the angle right. David seemed to recognize the purpose of those articles immediately, but he showed no signs of fear. The opposite, in fact, he smirked and shook his head.
"You are not going to get anything out of me with torture," he said.
David was a big man, fit and symmetrical, with a broad jaw, slick black hair, and sharp blue eyes. He wasn't a garden-variety perv or psycho, or at least he didn't look like one. Adding to that impression, he was wearing an immaculate black suit and a thin red tie. Andrew smiled thinly at the man and placed the chair on the floor, barely out of reach. He set the jerry can full of water and the rag beside him before taking a seat on the chair facing David. He withdrew the P320 from the waistband of his jeans and aimed it at the man's chest.
"If torture isn't going to work, then maybe I should just shoot you now and save us both the trouble," he suggested.
"Do that, and you'll never find out what happened to them."
A slow, quirky smile spread across his face.
"Not that I'm going to tell you."
With that, David began to laugh in an unhinged way that made Andrew's skin crawl. The laughter cut off abruptly and David's expression blanked. Andrew's brow furrowed.
"Them? You mean the people you abducted?"
David seemed to realize that he'd already said too much and he didn't elaborate further. Andrew's aim strayed to one of David's feet.
"We can see how many bullets you live through before the end. That's a nice compromise between torture and death, don't you think?"
David began laughing again, and his eyes rolled around in his head like marbles.
"Is he high?"
Andrew wondered. He nodded to the unconscious woman on the other side of the basement.
I bet she's wishing she was dead. Who is she, and why did you chain her up?
She's a loose end.
David adopted a giant grin that somehow looked wider than his entire face.
She came looking for her husband. Guess she missed sharing a bed with him, he chuckled. I filled in for him as best I could.
Rage boiled inside of Andrew as his worst fears were confirmed. So David had raped her. It took everything he had to keep from shooting David right then and there, but death was too good for him.
Who was her husband? Andrew demanded.
Some professor. I must be getting sloppy. First her, now you. That's two people who found me.
Was the professor's name Hughes?
Does it matter? Maybe I'm losing track.
Here's one for you.
Valeria Miller. Ring a bell? David's face blanked again, and he shook his head.
Why? Is that someone you care about?
He looked genuinely concerned for a moment, but then he began laughing like a maniac again.
All right, that's enough. Let's get started. See if we can clear your head a bit.
Andrew rose from the chair and rested his gun on the other side of the basement, right beside David's own weapon. When he was done, he dragged the chair into range of David along with the package of zip ties. David took his chance, but Andrew was expecting it. He rushed Andrew with what little slack his chain and zip-tied hands and legs could afford. He came waddling like an insane penguin. Andrew sidestepped before David could headbutt him and stuck out a leg to trip him. With no hands to throw out to cushion his fall, David fell flat on his face with an audible clack of teeth and a nasty crunch. He rolled over laughing again, his nose broken and leaking blood in rivers down his face.
Come on!
Andrew hauled him up and shoved him in the chair. Then he zip-tied him to the chair frame and dragged the chair over to a stack of cinder blocks. He used the blocks as a fulcrum to tilt the chair back and keep David's lungs above his head. That was the key, to avoid actually drowning him. With all of that in place, Andrew got down to business, using the jerry can to flood David's mouth, nose, and upper respiratory tract with water. He added the rag and held it tight over David's airways while pouring extra water over to keep him from simply coughing the water out. David still tried, and to some extent, he succeeded. After about a minute of letting him suffer, Andrew removed the rag and let him cough out the water.
"Tell me about Valeria Miller," he screamed as tears streamed from David's eyes.
But as soon as the man recovered enough to breathe, he began laughing like an idiot again.
"We're all going to be dead soon anyway. So what do you care if I took your daughter? You're not going to be around to see her."
Andrew felt a cold shock go through him. Everything went deathly quiet and still. David seemed to realize his mistake, and he paled.
"I didn't tell you she was my daughter,"
Andrew said. Before the man could reply, Andrew was waterboarding him again. This time, he did it three times in a row without even taking a break for a question in between. He kept going until David was delirious and sobbing.
"It's not personal,"
he cried.
"It is to me. Where is she?"
Andrew screamed in his ear.
"Screw you."
"Wrong answer."
Andrew grabbed a fistful of David's hair and yanked it right out of his head. He screamed like someone had set his head on fire, an idea that Andrew was seriously toying with.
"Tell me where she is, and I let you go."
"If I tell you, they'll kill me and my son."
"Your son?"
"Yes,"
David nodded, sounding somehow less crazy now. Was he somehow a victim in all this too?
No.
The woman chained up in his basement was clear evidence against that. Growing impatient, Andrew released the chair and went to fetch his gun. He grabbed the P320, flicked off the safety, and marched back over.
"What are you going to do? Kill me? Go ahead."
Andrew placed the gun to David's kneecap.
"Where is she?"
The crazy look was back in David's eyes, and another wide grin sprang to his bloody lips. His teeth were stained crimson by the river still trickling from his broken nose.
"She's dead. We had a real good time first, me and Valeria. Ugh,
David's eyes rolled as if with ecstasy.
She was a real fine piece of bang.
Gore splattered the concrete behind David's head. Andrew stared in shock at what he'd done, an instant replay repeating it in his head. He'd lost all sense of reason, his body moving before his brain could catch up. Before he could stop himself, he'd jammed his gun into one of David's rolling eyes and pulled the trigger. The monster stared, one-eyed, back at him, his bloody lips frozen in a grin. Andrew recoiled from the corpse, shaking with horror and disgust, but he wasn't horrified so much by what he'd done as by what David had just said. It couldn't be true. He refused to believe it. It didn't fit the M.O. This guy hadn't randomly abducted a few women and girls for his entertainment. That was a side plot to something much bigger. He'd abducted a professor, and Val's friend Anna, and her friend's brother Justin, and possibly others. They'd all been taken somewhere for some reason. And wherever they were, Val was with them. But now that David was dead, how the hell was he going to find them? Shit, he muttered. He flicked the safety back on his gun and slipped into his waistband with a shaking hand. As he did that, he heard chains rattling, followed by a soft moan. He turned to see the woman on the other side of the basement sitting up. Hope soared. Maybe she knew something about where the others had been taken. He ran over to her and she scuttled away from him, her eyes wide with terror.
"Leave me alone!"
she cried. Andrew raised his hands in a placating gesture.
"It's okay. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm going to free you. Okay?"
He cast about for something he could use to break her chains, and he found the padlock dangling from the cuff around her neck. He also noticed the blood crusted around the chain and the scabbed skin underneath.
"Where's the key?" Andrew asked.
She pointed with a dirty, shaking hand to where David's body sat, tied to the chair.
"Is he..."
she trailed off in a cracking voice.
"Don't worry, I didn't let him off easy," Andrew said.
She nodded, her eyes drifting out of focus. Andrew went to check David's pockets. He found the keys for the padlock in one of David's pants pockets, attached to the same ring as his house keys and Tesla key fob. His cell phone was in his other pocket and his wallet in the back. Andrew took all of those items and hurried over to unchain the woman. She stood up, hugging herself and looking terrified. Andrew realized she was still in her underwear and he grimaced.
"I'm going to find something clean for you to wear upstairs, okay?"
She nodded absently, her eyes on a discarded pile of clothes that he assumed belonged to her. He left David's keys, wallet, and phone in a heap on the floor. "I'll be right back," he said. Andrew vaulted up the stairs. Soon he was rifling through David's closet, finding suit after suit and very few actual clothes. Eventually, he settled on a black long-sleeve sweater, black pants and belt, socks, and a pair of tighty-whities. It was all probably far too big for the woman downstairs, but at least it was clean. Andrew ran out of the bedroom and back down the stairs to the basement.
"Got something for you to..." he trailed off, looking around for the woman.
She was gone. So were David's gun, his wallet, and his keys. She'd left the phone, but Andrew could see that the screen was on, with the lock screen visible. She'd only left it because she couldn't unlock it. He heard a door slam somewhere upstairs. He flew back up the staircase and ran down the hall to the front door. He yanked it open just in time to see the woman speeding away down the street in David's Tesla. Garbage and beer cans went flying as she blasted through the remains of the noise trap he'd set for David. Andrew's mind raced, his heart thundering in his chest and ears as he struggled to catch his breath. She was a witness to the murder he'd committed. Where was she going? Probably straight to the police.
"Damn it!"
Andrew rushed inside, hurrying into the basement. He snatched David's phone off the floor. If he could open it, there might be some other leads he could follow. He hunted through the rest of the house, moving as fast as he could. It didn't take long to find David's briefcase, loaded with items he'd used for his abductions: chloroform, a rag, a taser, and his laptop. There was a chance that the computer contained leads he could follow. Andrew snagged it off the kitchen counter and fled the house, slamming the door behind him and running down the street to his truck.
He needed to get the hell away from here before that woman told her story to the police. No doubt he'd left plenty to tie himself to the scene. Fibers, hairs, fingerprints. But with all of the shit about to hit the fan, it wouldn't matter. The cops were evacuating just like everyone else. The FBI agent he'd run into came to mind. She'd been following all the same leads as him. What if she found David Wilkes from that partial plate? Andrew shook his head. He only had to stay ahead of the authorities long enough to find Val. Saving her was all that mattered.
15. Val. 5 days left. Val sat on the dusty metal floor of the container truck, feeling every bump in the road. The air was close and stagnant with the sour smell of sweat and urine. They had a few buckets for toilets in the back, but the rough roads had made them slosh over. Val didn't have a watch or a phone, so she couldn't be sure, but her best guess was that they'd been on the road for at least half a day. All around her, people were whispering about their situation, others sobbing shamelessly. Her friend Anna sat beside her, holding her hand in a tight, sweaty fist.
"Where do you think they're taking us?"
Anna whispered. Val turned her head and caught a glint of her friend's eyes in the darkness, a sight only possible thanks to a few empty screw holes in the container walls and roof. She took a moment to consider the question. If it were still just the two of them in the trunk of that guy's Tesla, she would have been too scared to even venture a guess, but this wasn't that kind of abduction. There were almost 50 people crammed into this 40-foot container. Anna's brother Justin and his professor from university, along with dozens of men, women, and children that she'd never seen before in her life.
"What if this is some kind of human trafficking setup?"
Anna added, her voice spiking to a panicky register. That speculation set off murmurs of fear from nearby passengers.
"No,"
Val breathed.
"We're staring down the barrel of a dozen different natural disasters. The last thing anyone wants right now is more mouths to feed. This is something else." "How can you be so sure?"
Anna asked.
"For one thing, look at the demographics. We're not all kids. There are middle-aged people here, too. Human traffickers prey on children and young adults, not university professors."
Val added that last part as she gazed past Anna to her brother